Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Rising tensions in the Middle East. Markets attempt to break all-time highs, but fail. A new idea floated for the trade deal exposes political weakness, and stocks left for dead rebound bigly. All this and much more on episode number 628 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Really big hello to everybody out there today. Hopefully you're doing well. I'm Andrew Horowitz. I am the founder of Horowitz & Company. I'm the host of this show, of course. Horowitz Company is an investment advisory and financial planning firm, and I hope you had a good week. We had a pretty good week, and I guess kind of wonder what's happened in your neck of the woods, because there's a whole host of things that we found really interesting. I mean, it was a relatively jam-packed week with information related to trade and markets and headline bombs that were all, they were all over the place this week, weren't they? I mean, most of them were related, yes, to the trade deal. But there's some other things that really cropped up throughout the week that kind of were interesting in terms of the markets, aside from the fact that we had, of course, some interesting economic information that was revealed not only here in the United States, but around the world. But there's a lot of chatter going on. Just a lot of chatter, a little chit-chat that we find going on. And it's not a lot of substance in it, because it seems to be more of promises and trial balloons. It's something we've seen before. You know, we saw that this week China was going to hold off on this. U.S. was delaying tariffs on that for 2 weeks. And maybe because we're trying to be really nice, the Chinese 70th anniversary is coming up on October 1st. And, well, we don't want to spoil that party. Then we had the possibility of a partial or an interim trade deal that was then later denied and then later brought back again. And that was floated by the White House on Friday. The whole idea of, yeah, we could do an interim trade deal, something that we can maybe get going where, well, we'll have a partial deal for the things that are easy, quote unquote, easy to do. And then what we're going to have is a little time and breather and make sure everything is good. And then we're going to go into the more harder to deal with things. Now, if you don't believe this is general tape manipulation, market manipulation, then you're really naive. That's all this is. It's all about making sure that markets are happy. It's all about the idea that we have to make sure that the wealth effect continues on, and no matter what the underlying issue is in terms of politics or geopolitics or maybe even the economy, that everybody has a high level of confidence. And we've talked about this over the last several weeks. Something I've really been focusing in on, the idea of making sure that we understand this is a confidence game, not a con game, not a con job, but a confidence game. The whole market environment thrives on the idea that we have an agreement. We have confidence in the long-term prospect of companies and of markets and being able to make money and stay the course. Now, going back to this whole idea of what we're looking at this week, and I think it really bears some importance taking a look at this, because we started out, remember, a while back with this really incredible hard line that we're going to be pounding China into the ground if they don't agree with all the things that we talk about, all the areas that we laid out as the U.S. in terms of a trade deal, buying more agriculture, getting a handle on IP protection, putting teeth into any kind of deal. making sure there's no other theft of product that's going on, dumping of product in the United States, making sure that there is an equal amount of opportunity for U.S. to enter the U.S. into the China and China to be on our side, a balanced trade deal overall. All this was really important, and it was going to be merciless. There was going to be no mercy. We were going to make sure that the longer this went on, the more tariffs would be imposed, and the more difficulty that their markets would have, the more squeezing that we would do with their markets in order to make sure that they basically get the point that, hey, you know what? Either it's our way or the highway. And I always thought that, you know, I hear that. I see some of that. I see just these random increases overall in the area of tariffs and the increases that we're going to see on October 1st, then also on December 15th. But this whole idea of how we switched over recently to this whole, well, maybe we'll just do the easier part where we'll just agree on a few things in terms of trade, not the intellectual property, not maybe the dumping, but, you know, making sure that each party buys the other party's goods so that everything is just fine and we can make sure the economies look good. There's no further slowdown. And then later, sometime in the future, we're going to deal with the harder issues like IP and technology and all that. It really showed, I mean, I think it's pretty apparent. Unless you tell me that I'm totally out of my mind, it really shows how much politics are to play in this situation. And it's odd because what you find is that the people that have the most to lose, it seems, which is China, whose economy has been hurting, where it's been getting really hit in the area of manufacturing. In the U.S., the employment situation is still pretty good. 3.7% we saw last week. Spending is still strong. We saw retail sales at the end of last week. Markets are at all-time highs, or near all-time highs at least. Fed is on a rate cut process. And in fact, we saw more and more global stimulus being added last week. So when you think about that, and we'll get to what exactly happened in Europe in a second, but it appears that we had China on the ropes to a degree, or at least on their back foot. And then all of a sudden, we get this really weird idea floated that, hey, you know what? Maybe we'll postpone a few things. Maybe China's going to alleviate some of their tariffs. Maybe China's going to buy some more soybeans. And now all of a sudden, it appears that we're showing a really weak hand. So I'm not exactly sure what the negotiation process is and where the benefits are for this kind of result that we're seeing right now. But it does go along with what we talked about, that I thought that we were going to cave in and basically do just a watered-down deal to make it look good. Now, we saw, let's just get back to one point, then we'll kind of sum this all up. But we saw global stimulus because this trade war is actually affecting and impacting countries around the world. And the ECB noticed that there was a real problem with manufacturing and the economic, well, lack of economic growth in Europe. And they decided, you know what? By golly, we're going to start our QE bond buying program again. We're going to restart this. And if that's not enough as a parting gift, because we know that Mario Draghi is going to be leaving, I believe it's in November, he decided that, you know, Europe does need more stimulus. And what better way than to go further into the negative area of rates? So he dropped the benchmark rate from negative 0.4% to negative 0.5%. This is on top of all the other cuts we've seen around the world over the last several weeks. So there's clearly pressure from all sides, all areas around the world to get something done. There's no question about that. Anything. And maybe just provide good optics. Something that is, well, it seems good. It feels good. It's better. But it's not really quite there. And I really thought this was the best shot we had. If we don't do, listen, if we do not follow through on setting a really good program when it comes to intellectual property and technology and the deal that we have with China, if we don't do it now with all the things that are there, I very much do not believe that we'll be able to do it anytime in the future. I think China and the U.S. need to come together. And at this point right now, they need to figure out if they're going to do something or not. Let's get it over with already. And because I do believe this is showing a really weak hand by the U.S. And again, I don't think that necessarily China doesn't want to do a deal, but they want to do a deal that at least does not have the U.S. dictating the terms of how they deal with their own companies and the public and private companies in China. They want to, you know, if they want to fund their companies and they want to subsidize, that's fine. We do that to a degree. Didn't we just subsidize our farmers? Didn't we just cut the taxes here in the U.S. for companies? Isn't that a subsidy? Don't we do things that are beneficial for companies in our country, even though they are private, you know, private? Well, they're publicly traded, but, you know, private, non-government. So I think that's asking a lot to try to get involved in that. The other things, balancing the trade a bit, okay, I'm all for it. Ensuring that both parties have a deal together that are reasonable, have teeth, and that each can be accountable for with regard to technology and intellectual property, 100%. I'm right there. So we're going to see some additional buying of goods by China and a reduction of maybe some of the postponement or maybe leveling off of the tariffs. And I think that's it. We got a deal. I think that's all that's going to happen right now. And I think this, it appears at least, what is this? What is the whole point here? It's the old, let's create a problem, blame others, and then solve the problem and look like a hero. And that's a deal that we've done several times before over the last few years. And we did see the market react kind of favorably to some of this, but not as much as you would have anticipated. I think markets would do really well if we finalized a real trade deal, not an interim trade deal. If we did get some resolution on some of the important and key aspects of all the outstanding items, because again, I do not believe that if we do, I believe that if we don't get a deal done now with all that we have at stake, with all the tariffs that we have, with all the fighting that's going on, with all the anxiety and aggravation that's gone into this, I think we're going to be hard-pressed to ever do a deal. And if President Trump backs down at this point, then he wasn't serious about it to begin with, which I didn't think he was. I think he wanted to get a little bit out. Maybe he said, you know, we're going to ask for this, but if we get this down here just a little bit, we'll be happy. So the markets are getting towards the all-time highs again with the idea that maybe there is some resolution. The S&P closed very close to the all-time high, backed off a little bit. Same thing for the NASDAQ and the Dow Jones Industrial Average. Small caps are still down about 10% from their all-time highs. What was also interesting last week was that one of the things we noticed was there was some really significant gains in a very select group of companies. And upon further investigation, what we found was it was the highest shorted stocks and many stocks that have had the greatest drop over the past year or so. These companies really got some interest. These are companies that were like left for dead. Companies that was like, oh yeah, man, especially in the retail area. This guy's going out of business, that one's going out of business, and you know, this very high short interest, down 50, 60, 70% over the last year or so, and all of a sudden, we saw that this incredible move, 20, 30, 40, 50% during the week. And while some of it may be a hope the hope trade. Some of it, I think, really is the realization and thought process gone in that some of these names, like Francesca's, Chico's, Express, Office Depot, who else was it, Gap, they're not going to go bankrupt. They're going to have a lot of difficulty, but maybe they'll be bought. Maybe they'll merge. Maybe they'll just hang on by a thread for a long period of time. And even if they go through a restructuring process, maybe, just maybe, they will come out the other side and really have an opportunity to show some decent numbers in the future. I mean, these companies rocketed last week. I do believe that they are zombies a-walking. And I also believe it was an algo short squeeze that made this all happen. And you'll see, for example, some companies that reported, it was Tailored Brands that also moved up dramatically. And then when the earnings came out, it was another realization that, oh, this is not so good. Stock was down like 25% after the earnings were announced. So I think what you're getting right now is a short squeeze. And on some of these low price stocks, these squeezes can be pretty significant and brutal. And shorts are running for the hills and just trying to cover. And since this kind of limited liquidity, it's really popping these names pretty good. And I really think that's all it was about. We could probably try to come up with all these different reasons why, technically basing out, nowhere else to go on the downside, optimism about retail sales, consumers are still strong, you know, there is the potential for some merger acquisition, interest rates are low, so therefore they can get cheap debt and put debt out there and kind of recapitalize and all the things that we could think about. But at the end of the day, they're still struggling. So something to look at, see where they go. You got to look at Francesca's symbol, FRAN. That had quite the week. I mean, I think one day it was up like 240%. And then it followed through the next couple of days after that towards the end of the week. So pretty interesting. We looked at those. I do the Friday morning market rundown at 9 a.m. for Trigger Charts. If you haven't done it, we do a webinar. You can go over to triggercharts.com and sign up for a reserve. It's free, so you can reserve your place. And each and every Friday, we talk about the things that are moving markets, touch on some of the eco world issues to begin with, then go right to the charts, and you're looking at my screen as we are looking at various names that are of interest, the market levels themselves, a couple of key indicators. We go through a lot of different things, plus talk about your stocks. So if you want to check that out, go over to triggercharts.com. You can sign up for the free webinar. Okay, what are we? Oh. Some craziness over the weekend. We had some nutty stuff going on in Saudi Arabia. So you've probably seen this, of course. There was these drone strikes that hit oil installations, taking about 50% of the production offline in Saudi Arabia, targeting Saudi Aramco. Now, of course, this is going to be temporary. And I think it was really interesting that we need to really get into the timing of all this. And while the fires are under control and we'll see some of these facilities come back online eventually, oil prices are probably going to see a pretty sassy move when markets open Sunday night into Monday. But the problem is this situation really relates to only about 5% of the world's oil production. So if 50% is offline, we're dealing with maybe 2.5%. It will take up some time to bring it back up online, but they will. Now, of course, we have the overhang of, drone strikes. How easy was that to do? I think it was 10 different drones with some kind of missiles or some kind of explosive devices got on two different installations, and how do we stop those in the future? I mean, I don't know, nets, cannons, radar, lasers, I don't know, right? They're going to have to do something. It was that easy for them just to get bombed. And the problem is that right now we're blaming Iran on the attacks. And even though they're denying it, of course, I find that the timing of all this is really, really interesting. Remember that Just last week, we saw that National Security Advisor Bolton was fired. And he was one of the biggest opponents to any kind of a deal with Iran. He was the antagonist, if you will, in the Trump administration, saying that, hey, bad actors, bad people, don't do a deal with them. And just last week, Trump said that he would potentially like to lift some of the sanctions on Iran. And all of a sudden, Iran supposedly is bombing Saudi Arabia. And we know that they're enriching more uranium that they are, quote unquote, allowed to. They made the announcement about a 20% increase over the top of where they are allowed to enrich uranium. Okay. That was supposed to be a major line that was drawn that we would not allow them to do. All right. But why in the world, why would they do these attacks on Saudi Arabia? And is there anything to do with this timing? Which there may be. Oftentimes you find where there's a transition in the White House or from one president to the other, or you see something going on that is maybe a little political upheaval in Congress, in the U.S., a lot of those out there that don't like us so much try to push, try to see how far they can get. Now, they know that we're all, you know, all for oil prices being low. We know that we're trying to be friendly with Saudi Arabia. And on the news that John Bolton was fired or resigned, depending on who's telling you the story, oil dropped dramatically because the thought was that, again, President Trump may in fact say, you know, Bolton gave me some really bad advice and I didn't like what he did and really want to try to step up negotiations with Iran. And by doing so, lifting sanctions would allow them to pump more oil. Stocks came, price of oil came down very significantly on the announcement. So maybe, just maybe, got to think about who needs or wants oil prices to rise. And were those people and parties involved in the bombings? Listen, how many times have we seen when oil prices get, quote, too low, there's an attack on a Nigerian pipeline out of nowhere? Or some of the issue in the Gulf kicks up. I don't know. They are some skirmishes. Or maybe they take a boat, a ship, an oil tanker. So timing to me seems really suspect. Now, the good news is that the U.S. is much less reliant on Middle Eastern oil. So that may put a little bit of a cap on WTI crude. May see Brent move up a little bit more because that obviously is more related to the Middle East oil. And President Trump has already said that the U.S. is going to open up the strategic oil reserves and need to make sure that there's availability of oil and not a lot of concern in the market pricing. I don't think that's necessary. I think way ahead of any problem because it's only been a day or so. Unless there's an overhang on this, and maybe there's somebody that is some people that are going to be very concerned about what's happening there and the likelihood of another attack in the future, or if they can't get these installations back online. But again, it's only about a 5% of the total production of the world. I don't think it's a big deal. I really don't think it's that big of a deal. But already there's, you know, all these, you know, chitter chatter coming around and trial balloons and promises made that, don't you worry, we got you covered. So that's going to be interesting to watch what does happen with regard to that. The Saudi markets were down. Now they are even for the year. They were up, I think, maybe about 19% at their peak. And as oil started coming down, and now with this and concern about what's happening in Saudi Arabia, if there's going to be some further flare-ups in the region, that stock market over the weekend, they're open over the weekend, came down about 2.5%, I believe it was, towards the end of the day and towards the close. So something to keep an eye on. I think it's going to be reflective in at least some volatility in oil probably immediately. But again, I don't necessarily think that that's a long-term proposition considering everything that we know. 20 years ago, this would be a problem. And 20 years ago when there was a major reliance on the entire world and they had a much greater exposure, this could be a problem. It's going to be probably a problem for the Saudi Aramco IPO that's being pushed up once again. Remember about a year or so ago, they wanted to go and bring this public, but then they shut it down. And now that oil prices started moving up again, they were comfortable doing it, but now oil prices are moving down again. So with that and this and concern about possibly the disruption that's going on there and the political instability that may be affecting the region right now, it may push this whole IPO back once again. I have to see what happens with this. But if nothing else, pretty interesting. Now, I just want to get to the main topic of what I want to talk about today. Because this week I had two really interesting conversations. And they were kind of somewhat related. And it involves new investors. So the first conversation I had was with my son. And he was starting his first IRA. And he asked me all sorts of questions. I mean, he was, all right, listen, you know, how much money can I make? How much money can I put in? All the things that you expect a new investor in an IRA to be asking, right? All these questions about how it would work, the structure, what was involved, you know, when can he take out money? What are the penalties? Okay, great stuff. And what I thought it would really be a good idea to do was to show him the potential of investing in, and in particular, once again, review the whole idea of compounding interest over time. So we went out for like 30 years and I showed how investing over time can really obviously add up depending on what interest rate assumption you have. But really the whole idea was the length of time that you have is really beneficial. The earlier you start, the more potential you have, no matter what the interest rate is. And what we did was we started to look at, okay, well, what happens if I wait a year or maybe start putting in a small amount than I should right now and then put in more later? And we went through this whole process and showed how much more you have if you start early and if you continue doing it through your lifetime. That was kind of an interesting discussion. But the really interesting conversation that I had this week was with an acquaintance. I'll call him an acquaintance who's a bit older, approaching about 50 years old. I was at a party, and during that discussion, I was kind of moving around, talking to a lot of people, and then a guy that I'd known for a few years, who again approaching about 50, kind of started asking me about what I do, wanted to kind of find out some more information about investing, as you know, just a general conversation. And then we talked about what was involved and how you do it. And he had a lot of these preconceived notions that were just like just coming out fast and furious. I mean, he was talking about all sorts of things. And I listened to all the reasons and kind of just really just sat back and said, okay, all right. Yep. Mm-hmm. And he was talking about all the reasons not to invest and why he didn't do it over his lifetime and stories about Madoff, market crashes, and his take on all of that. I mean, it really seemed like this incredibly unbearable internal struggle he was having that was preventing him from doing anything productive with his money. He worried about losing money if he invested because he wanted to be aggressive. And why not, he said. Let's treat it like gambling money. So that mentally he's set. If he loses money under that scenario, right, what happens? Well, I knew it was money that I could lose anyway, and I was gambling it away, and I don't have to worry about it. So on one hand, he wanted to be really aggressive. On the other hand, he was like, well, I don't want to lose it. It was money they would never need, but yet he didn't want to lose money. No wonder he never invested. Again, this internal struggle that he was trying to put together all these reasons why not to invest, making a lot of stuff up along the way. And then sort of agreeing with himself of, that's a good reason not to invest. No, yeah, I'm not investing because of this or that. And in the end, he really hurt himself. So I tried to explain a few things. First thing I tried to really focus in on was his concern related to the idea about the account just simply disappearing one day, just waking up and reading a news headline that his advisor or the people that he gave the money to were no longer around, you know, the Madoff situation. And talked about this and explained to him that, you know, listen, and this is, I think, a lesson for everybody, but I said, listen, you're not going to write a check to your payable to your advisor. Always fund the account through a reputable third party, you know, like a custodian or a broker dealer. And your account should be held at a broker dealer, or if you want to call it a custodian, kind of interchangeable to a degree, not the advisor. And you should be getting your statements from the custodian and trading confirmations and information and other account details from the custodian as well. Now, listen, the advisor may actually send you consolidated reports that give you maybe performance information, may give you an asset allocation, sector allocations. It may provide you a lot of other information along the way, but you need to have access to the broker or the custodian to check to make sure that, yes, these are the assets that are in my account. So you have a system of checks and balances there. Whereas people went wrong with Madoff, for example, and other deals that weren't like this, is that the broker dealer and the advisor were oftentimes the same, or the advisor owned the broker dealer, whereas they can access the monies. So there needs to be that separation. So the next thing I tried to do after we kind of got onto into this discussion is I wanted to go over his reasons that he wanted to be so aggressive. Remember, he told me that he didn't invest in stocks or bonds or funds, anything. And again, these are reasons he didn't like to lose his hard-earned money in the market. But if he had to, he wanted to be really aggressive and take the position that it was gambling and all of it. Put it all to work, and why not? And I had to stop him. I said, listen, I don't know where you're going with this, but this isn't the right mindset. I said, come on. Let's start with square one. One of the reasons you're not doing this is you're setting up all these different reasons and roadblocks that you're convincing yourself about, so therefore you're not investing. And I said to him that when he thinks about risk and he thinks about the idea of markets, it's not gambling. He needs to kind of rethink his whole risk tolerance level to align with his core psychological beliefs about money and his own comfort about it. Yeah, we could say the sleep at night factor. If he's going to be just throwing the money and gambling, you know what it's going to do? He knows he's going to be watching this like a hawk all the time. Look at his portfolio values. He'll get some kind of an app, I'm sure. He'll look at his portfolio values all the time. He's going to get crazy with this. And you know what? In the back of his mind, he's probably saying, I don't want to get crazy. I don't want to be involved in this. I don't want to have this, you know, this whole feeling of ups and downs all the time and me getting nauseous about being up and then losing the money. How could he think about saving up $50,000, $20,000, $100,000 and investing for the first time in risk assets in an all or nothing proposition? At the same time, having a conservative mindset. He'll be terrorized by the market swings. Incapacitated on a regular basis by these moves. I mean, think about it, right? How could he function? So he decides not to invest because he knows this is going to be the case. Makes up all these reasons why he shouldn't invest, therefore doesn't invest. Essentially setting himself up for failure. only one specific outcome, which is his money will grow and never see any downside, is going to probably be the way that it has to go for him to stay the course. Anything else is going to be disastrous. Any kind of market swing, any kind of movement up or down, or down primarily, is going to make him want to just pull it all out or just disassociate. He's going to be paralyzed from this whole process. And you know what's going to happen? If he does lose, he's never going to invest another dollar. So I said to him, listen, you can't do this. You're killing yourself. You're working really hard for your money, and you're not letting your money work hard for you, because you've set up all these parameters that you created. The market's too high. I don't like this economy. I don't like this congressperson. I don't, you know, I think that, well, you know, we're in for a recession because the last time we were at these levels, and it can't be as good. There's some fake numbers coming out. I mean, on and on and on and on about all the reasons why not to invest. So I explained the idea about investing along with his risk tolerance level, the whole concept of making sure that your time horizon and your risk tolerance matches who you are. I actually went into some detail on this. I talked about the diversification process. I talked about how, you know, if you have an appropriately balanced portfolio that is in line with your risk tolerance and time horizon, you don't have to make up all these stories. I provided him like some of these. Again, we were at a party, so there's only so much I could do. I provided a kind of a sketch of a long-term goals for a conservative investor, which is what he's telling me he is. He's not an aggressive long-term investor that, or an aggressive swing trader or a day trader. In his, you know, he would think he would like to be that, but he's not, and that's the reason why he hasn't invested, because he's concerned about the volatility and losing money. And then I showed him, like, okay, well, markets did this on average over the last 20 years, 30 years, 50 years, whatever it is. So he says, well, wait a minute. If I make 6 to 8% a year, what's the point? And I thought, what? And I said to him, well, what are you making on your money now? He says, like, 1%. It's no good, but at least I feel safe. I said, well, if you would have had 5% as a number over the last 10 years, you'd be 4% ahead. Maybe he was making a little bit more. So let's say let's say 2% a year. You'd be better off over the last 10 years. That's 20% more compounded of your money. Again, I was like, you gotta have your money working for you, whether it's really conservatively, but at least in a smart an intelligent manner, or if it's aggressive, that's fine also, but at least let's match it all up and make sure that you are properly balanced. And I tried to show him this is not an all or nothing game. You know, the whole idea of this gambling, oh, I'm going to put it in there and I'm going to believe that, if I lose it, no. I explained that if you have $50,000, $100,000, $200,000 to invest, you don't need to invest it all at once. You should probably start slow and get comfortable. I mean, you're paralyzed about all these things that you've made up. You've decided that you got to be gambling your money. And as such, you're not going to, and you need to put your full amount in to go. I said, no. We've already debunked the whole idea of okay, well, I put my money in, I don't want to get ripped off. So we talked about the Chinese wall, if you will, or the wall that's between you, your money, the advisor, and the broker. Okay, we got that settled. Talked about the whole idea of match your risk tolerance. Okay, got that settled. Now you don't need to all put all your money in and just be flummoxed and worried about that all the time. So what you should do is probably start out slow. Then add to it. Maybe if you have $100,000 to invest, maybe start with 25. And maybe start with a conservative portfolio, right? Because why bother getting in over your head to begin with? Let's start slow. Let's get your money rocking for you over time. Again, there's no guarantee here, but you know, let's get it at least in position. Then add to it. Update your risk tolerance level over time and then see how it goes. The point, I said to him, is you need to get in the game. You can't be sitting on the sidelines and expecting to win anything if you're just kind of tapping and wahoo, nice pass. You have to play on the court. To even have the slightest shot of success, you need to get in there. And creating all these reasons why not to play, maybe I'll sprain an ankle. Maybe I don't know the rules. I don't know what to do. What if I lose? I mean, the only way to get started is to get started. So I'm not sure if I totally got through on all the ideas that I wanted to provide, but right then, kind of as I finished my discussion with him, I realized something once again. This is exactly the reason why we created Investology. The whole point was that we wanted to set these minimum investments to an entry point level that was low enough to allow people, anyone that had some money, to get started investing. And because we had all the ranges of risk from really conservative to aggressive, that was based on your risk tolerance score and your time horizon, all that, it was right there for you, the starter package. So I explained the, take another second, I explained the process and to explain the program. I think somewhere by the time we finished this conversation, kind of a light bulb went off in his head because he said something. He said, so wait a minute. So I don't have to invest my entire savings and I can adjust the risk of the portfolio, you know, what I want it to be. I'm like, yes. So I think I made some headway there. And I think that maybe he's going to get in the game or at least get on the court. He doesn't have to start playing hard right away, but I think he's going to start practice. That's a true story. Just this weekend, I bet that many of you have also had a lot of these similar blocking thoughts, this internal, this struggle that you've had about investing and, well, maybe not the time. You probably said that for the last 5 years. What if I get in now and markets go down? And probably said that over the last 5 years. I want to get on the lows. You probably said that over the last 5 years. So if you've had some of these thoughts, perhaps maybe what I've told you and what I've explained about what is maybe holding you back, some voices telling you things that may go wrong and preventing you from ever getting in on the game. And for those of you that are totally new at this, and if this is resonating with you, remember something. This is not black and white. It's not all or nothing. There are so many different options available to you. Yeah, you could start slow, build up your knowledge, your courage to invest. You don't have to be super aggressive to start. I mean, you should get yourself comfortable. Allow yourself, give yourself permission to get comfortable. And remember that it's a long-term process. It's not necessarily timing the market that's the most important, but it's the time in the market that's important. And when I say market, that's a general discussion. It could be bonds, it could be alternative assets, it could be commodities, whatever the market is. The concept of a diversified approach to investing, covering a lot of areas domestically, internationally, large, small cap, the whole gamut. Start somewhere, for goodness sakes, and have your money working for you. I mean, that's the takeaway that I got from the conversation I had. Put your excuses aside. And if you follow the basic principles, I think there's some reward waiting for you in the end. Yeah, investing is risky and you have the potential to lose some or all of your money, frankly. But if you consider a well-diversified portfolio, you have some great historical references on your side. So getting back to basics a little bit here, I thought it was a really great conversation. Well, if he didn't have a light bulb that went off, I did. Getting rid of these preconceptions and these preconceived ideas that are holding you back from actually doing what you really know you should be doing before you hit 60 years old, when you only have a few years left to retire, and you kick yourself the whole time of, oh, look what I could have done, look what I should have done. No shoulda, couldas. Time is clicking along as we go, as we speak. Minutes turn into hours, turn into days, turn into weeks, turn into years, turn into decades. And by the time you turn around, all these excuses that you utilize for all of this, where did it get you? So I know I'm coming off kind of hard on this, kind of tough in your face. It's a bit of a tough love conversation. Think of it that way. So I want to make sure that you're not having these mental roadblocks, these kind of these internal struggles that are preventing you from doing what you know you need to do. Whatever your level of risk is, whatever your time horizon is. So hopefully that hit home a little bit and got you a little revved up. Instead of all these, everything else that we talk about, that you're thinking about this noise and it's infectious. And right now, too, we have a lot of that going on. So it's probably, but you know, you make a lot of sense there, Horowitz. Yeah, love everything you just said there. But, you know, what about all this? What about the tariffs? What about the fact that we have markets that are close to all-time highs and the CAPE ratio and manufacturing? You've even talked about this stuff in here and you're concerned about. I'm concerned about this stuff over the next few months, over the next year, maybe, but not the next 10, 15 years. Next 10, 15 years, that's a totally different discussion. So make sure you're listening carefully. You're listening to the right cues as we go through this. That's going to end it for today. I hope you have a great week. Hopefully I didn't bruise anybody too badly on that. Maybe you saw yourself in a little bit of that discussion. Maybe it motivated somebody to do something. To think about, yeah, maybe it is a long-term game. Yeah, we talk a lot about short-term trading and opportunities, but I'm talking about the much bigger picture, the walk back, and then the walk back from there, and then the step back, and then the kind of the turnaround, and then look from afar concept. That's what we're talking about here. Don't get hung up on everything you see, read, and listen to. So we're going to talk to you next week. I have a very busy week on my hands here. DH Unplugged will be on Tuesday night with myself and John C. Dvorak, of course, at dhunplugged.com. You check that out live and streaming at 9 p.m. on Tuesday evening. Other than that, if you want to get in touch with us, you know how to do so. Go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. You can check out Investology, of course, all the other strategies that we have as well. And otherwise, I hope you have a great week, profitable week, and I'll see you on the other side. Thanks so much. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as a sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training.